israelstory.org. Thanks for tuning in. It's 6 o'clock.
Good morning. Israel was not part of negotiations with the U.S. to end the war they started against Iran. Does its government think that it will be bound by that agreement? Israel's ambassador to the U.S. joins us on this hour of Morning Edition from NPR News. Georgia Senator Raphael Warnock describes the fundamental differences in how he and House Speaker Mike Johnson understand their faith. I'm Amy Martinez.
And I'm Leila Fadel. Warnock says Democrats have ceded too much religious ground to the right. Also, a Kentucky jail holds immigrants detained by ICE and gets paid to do it. An official sees it as a way to offset expenses. And imagining a world in which AI bots become our personal shoppers. It's Tuesday, June 16th, Bloom's Day. It's the day Leopold Bloom wanders around Dublin in James Joyce's Ulysses. The news is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Trump is at the G7 meeting of leaders in France. Last hour, he praised the new agreement with Iran to end the war. He insists the deal will not allow Iran to have a nuclear weapon, although details of the agreement have not been disclosed. NPR's Daniel Kurtzleben says some European leaders have started to express praise for the deal.
It's possible the leaders of G7 countries, a group that includes Canada, the UK, France, Germany, Italy, and Japan, that they're going to praise Trump even while they're pretty frustrated with him. I mean, this war hurt their economies and economies all over the world, after all. And additionally, we did see Trump get upset when some European countries didn't help out with the war to his liking, such as allowing the U.S. to use their airspace.
NPR's Danielle Kurtzleben reporting. There are elections across the country today. Oklahoma and Washington, D.C. will hold primaries. Alabama and Georgia are holding runoffs. In Georgia's GOP gubernatorial runoff, Lieutenant Governor Burt Jones is campaigning against billionaire healthcare executive Rick Jackson. California Governor Gavin Newsom says he is being investigated by the Justice Department. From member station KQED, Guy Marzorati reports Newsom says the probe is in response to his opposition to President Trump.
In a video released Monday, Newsom says federal agents have contacted friends and demanded records.
Donald Trump isn't just coming after me because of my mean tweets. He's coming after me because I'm considering running for president.
The governor's office says federal agents are also looking into the work of Newsom's wife, filmmaker Jennifer Siebel Newsom. The focus of the investigation is not yet clear. Newsom's office has filed a Freedom of Information request with the Department of Justice regarding the probe. The Justice Department did not immediately respond to a request for comment. For NPR News, I'm Guy Marzorati in San Jose.
New data show that starter homes in a record number of cities now cost $1 million or more. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports it's part of a surge in home prices since 2020.
New data from the real estate website Zillow finds 242 cities have million-dollar entry-level homes. That's three times as many as before the pandemic housing boom. Most places are in California, but the fastest growth is in New York and New Jersey. Million-dollar starters have also spread to interior states like Texas, Wyoming, and Illinois. They're defined here as the lowest third of the market in a region. Despite that, Zillow finds that nationwide, the typical starter home is still a lot less, just under $200,000. A housing shortage has priced out many first-time buyers, but Zillow finds the tough market easing a bit, with more inventory and prices growing more slowly. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Policymakers for the Federal Reserve open their two-day interest rate setting meeting today in Washington, D.C. Kevin Warsh will lead his first meeting as the new Fed chair. African countries are bringing home some of their nationals from South Africa. There's been a renewed wave of attacks on migrants there. NPR's Kate Bartlett reports hundreds of people from Malawi are waiting in a makeshift camp in Durban, South Africa, to be repatriated.
Nigeria, Mozambique, and Ghana are some of the other countries that have already helped repatriate their citizens from South Africa in the past month as foreigners flee a rising tide of xenophobia. Several Mozambicans have been killed, foreign-owned businesses have been looted, and vigilante gangs roam the streets asking people for their identity cards. One of the groups leading the charge is called March on March. It has given non-South Africans a June 30th ultimatum to leave the country, or else. South African President Cyril Ramaphosa has condemned the violence while also vowing to crack down on illegal immigration. But the country is suffering from huge levels of unemployment and crime, and migrants have become an easy scapegoat. Kate Bartlett, NPR News, Johannesburg.
In the U.S., there are flood watches posted across the Gulf Coast areas from Texas to Mississippi this morning. The National Weather Service says very heavy rain could trigger flash flooding in some areas. Separately, heat cautions persist in the West, including in Oregon, California, and parts of Nevada. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Lilly Endowment, a private foundation supporting NPR's coverage of religion and spirituality, and Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts.
When you tune into KEXE, you'll hear our phonology students reminding us to pay attention to nature.
Hello from Mr. Masakovic's class at Baxter Elementary School. This past week brought our first substantial rainfall on one day.
Canadian thistle has popped up.
Greetings from the fourth grade phonology team in the Linwood School Forest. This is Eliza,
Charlie, and Mary
reporting on our observations for the week ending May 1st.
This week, we observed our lilac have many sets of leaves on it.
Hi, this is Carson
and Reese from Crooked Lake Elementary School in Andover, reporting from Long Lake Conservation Center for April 29th through May 1st. The weather was sunny but cool with a high temperature of 48 degrees Fahrenheit.
This concludes the phonology report. Have a great week and be observant.
Keep exploring, keep discovering, and keep connecting with the great outdoors.
KEXE celebrating 50 years of people-powered radio.
It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm A. Martinez. The U.S. and Iran will sign an agreement to negotiate an end to the war this Friday in Switzerland. What those negotiations will look like are still not clear.
But what is known is that Israel, which began the war with the U.S., will not be a party at those talks. Israel's prime minister has been sidelined in the agreement and could be a spoiler in negotiations to end the war. In a few moments, we'll speak with Israel's ambassador to the U.S., Michael Leiter. We begin with NPR's Carrie Kahn in Tel Aviv.
So, Carrie, what's in the agreement that Israel does not like?
It's not so much what is in the agreement, but what is not. We don't have a lot of the details yet, as you said. But first and foremost, for Israel, there is no stated plan to deal with Iran's nuclear capabilities. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu says that's why Israel started the war with Iran in the first place, to prevent what he said was this imminent nuclear threat, right? But the agreement being signed is just a commitment to negotiate, and that's concerning to Israel. Also unclear what will happen to Iran's proxies fighting with Israel, Hezbollah in Lebanon, and Hamas in Gaza. And Israel rejects Tehran's demands for Israel's withdrawal from all Lebanese territory, which Israel has significantly attacked and occupied during this war. And that's something Netanyahu says will not happen. And that could be a major sticking point in getting this pact even signed.
And what is Netanyahu saying publicly about that and not being part of the negotiations to end the war?
He is not happy, and he's getting a lot of heat here at home for it. He held a press conference last night and immediately addressed the criticism that his goals were not met, especially Iran's nuclear question, which he calls his life's mission, not to allow Iran to get a nuclear weapon. He says that will remain his priority. He was asked, of course, about his relationship with Trump. Recently, Trump has publicly called Netanyahu crazy, difficult, ungrateful. Netanyahu clearly didn't want to address any rift. He just said, look, Trump doesn't do everything I say, nor do I do everything Trump asks.
שמכירים אחד את השני הרבה פעמים, אמרתי מסכימים הרבה פעמים.
We are partners and often we agree and sometimes we disagree. That happens in the best of families, was all he would say.
All right, so what are Israelis saying about the deal?
There seems to be widespread dissatisfaction with the deal from the streets to the political corridors. Here's Ori Ben-Ami. He's a communication and relationship coach that we talked to in Tel Aviv. He called the deal shameful as it leaves Israel out of the picture and Hezbollah still active in Lebanon and Hamas still in Gaza.
I think it's a loss for us. We did a lot of effort. We've been through a hell of time here in Israel. It seems like not for a lot of benefit.
Political opponents and Netanyahu's allies are hammering him over it. Remember, elections are coming this fall. The far right, even those in Netanyahu's governing coalition, are calling it dangerous. And just remember, a few months back, Netanyahu saw a very different political landscape here for himself. He and the U.S. together would bring down Iran and he would sail to another electoral victory. Now, just months before voters go to the polls, he has this very public rift with the U.S. president, and he is left out of negotiating the war's end.
That's NPR's Carrie Kahn in Tel Aviv. Carrie, thanks.
You're welcome.
Israel's ambassador to the United States has been listening with us. Ambassador Michael Leiter, welcome.
Good morning, Steve. Good to be with you.
Based on what you know so far, is this agreement between the U.S. and Iran a good deal?
Well, first of all, we don't know the details. And secondly, it's not a deal. It's an MOU to discuss a deal. So we're encouraged by the fact that the president has been consistently unequivocal about preventing Iran from achieving a nuclear weapon. And we're very encouraged about that. We're less encouraged about the fact that it seems that Lebanon has been included in an agreement with Iran. And we think that that's unnecessary and unhelpful.
Let's talk that through. What is your best understanding, Ambassador, of what is required of Israel in Lebanon based on this agreement?
Well, we have an agreement with the United States and with the government of Lebanon, actually, that a ceasefire will be implemented in Lebanon, which we've agreed to, on the condition that Hezbollah pull back all of its fighters, all of its terrorists, north of the Litani River. This, by the way, is an agreement which has been repeated some three times in UN Security Council resolutions. And Hezbollah has not been a party to that agreement. They continue to defy the government of Lebanon and continue to occupy South Lebanon. I mean, just yesterday, we discovered a cache in the Western District in South Lebanon of dozens of killer drones, 5 ton of explosives. So this is something that we simply can't live with. We can't have jihadi terrorists on our border.
I want to just talk through a little bit of the geography for people, Ambassador. You mentioned the Litani River. That is, of course, a landmark in southern Lebanon. You're telling us that Israeli troops are holding the area south of that. Iran's foreign minister claims that this agreement requires you to withdraw forces from Lebanon, to get off of Lebanese territory. Do you think you're required to do that?
No, absolutely not. As a matter of fact, the administration was crystal clear that this agreement has nothing to do with our withdrawal from South Lebanon. We're not going to withdraw from South Lebanon. And the madmen of Tehran have no business poking their nose into Lebanon. This is precisely the issue that we're dealing with, Iran being a regional hegemon. Iran has no business in Lebanon. The Lebanese want the Iranian IRGC out of there. They want Hezbollah out. And what's really fascinating, Steve, is that Israel and Lebanon are on the exact same page as far as this is concerned. We want Hezbollah away from the people of Lebanon. We want Hezbollah away from our border. We don't need this Iranian proxy wreaking havoc, mayhem, death, and destruction in our midst.
I want to be clear. You said we're not withdrawing from southern Lebanon, meaning that if Iran says that's a deal breaker, this longer negotiation is not going to work, Israel nevertheless is on its course. Is that right?
Israel is in South Lebanon to protect its people like any self-respecting country would do. And as far as the Iranians are concerned, it's not a deal breaker for them. They have a lot of rhetoric. They sound off. These are murderers who have a lot of rhetoric about themselves, but this isn't a deal breaker. If they want peace with the United States, they're not going to stick Lebanon in.
Before asking this next question, let me acknowledge that Israelis have been killed by Hezbollah recently, and many of them over a period of time, and some of them recently. However, during the Israeli response, in the back and forth between Israel and Hezbollah, roughly 3,700 Lebanese are dead, according to Lebanese health authorities, and they include women and children. About 1 million people are thought to be out of their homes. And if Israel is staying, it sounds like 1 million people are going to remain out of their homes. What responsibility, if any, does Israel have for civilians affected by your military operations?
The people we've killed, Steve, are Hezbollah terrorists. We don't target civilians. And the notion that you can fight against asymmetric warfare with terrorists embedded within civilians who actually celebrate the maximalization of civilian casualties is very difficult, and I don't think anybody else in the world would be able to contend with it better than we have. We hope that the 1 million people who have been displaced will be able to return to their homes, as we hope that the Israelis who have been displaced from their homes because of Hezbollah rockets will return to their homes. But it is ultimately on the onus is on the government of Lebanon to see to it that there's no Hezbollah south of the Litani River. And that's ultimately what we're working towards.
Ambassador, my understanding of Prime Minister Netanyahu's view on Iran long term is that fundamentally you can make no agreement with this regime, that there really would be no agreement the U.S. could make that Israel would be likely to find to be wise or acceptable. Is that how he sees it now?
Look, the people of the Ayatollahs of Iran are liars. They have lied every time they've entered into an agreement. These are madmen who have killed people indiscriminately, 40,000 of their own just in January. And if there's going to be a deal, it's ultimately the decision of the President of the United States. We don't weigh in on that. We can express our opinion, but we're a junior partner. And the senior partner, the United States, makes its decision on the based on their America foreign policy interests, and we respect that. We hope that any deal that would be achieved with them would be one which could be verified. I would say distrust and verify.
Meaning that you would, it sounds like you would find any deal to be unwise, but if the United States is determined, you would suggest ways to make it better. Am I understanding you correctly?
You are. If it's a deal which absolutely verifies that they will never achieve nuclear weapons, that there will not be a nuclear bomb in the hands of these madmen, that they will not have ballistic missiles that could terrorize and hold the entire region hostage, and they will discontinue any support for proxies like the Houthis, Hamas, and Hezbollah, which are constantly threatening our very existence, and international waterways at the same time, that would be a deal that would work. But we'd have to be in a situation where it can be verified at any time, anywhere, under any circumstances.
Ambassador, one other thing to ask about in the minute or so we have left. You must think about this as ambassador to the United States. A number of surveys over time have shown a broad decline in support for Israel in the United States. How do you account for that, and what do you want to do about it?
Well, first of all, my approach as ambassador is to work very hard on the bipartisan plane. Anytime I go to Congress, as I'm going in a few hours, it'll be divided between Democrats and Republicans. But I think we have to bear in mind that the U.S. As a whole is undergoing social change. You know, it's been a long time since avowed socialists have been elected to office. So in the context of that change, there is anti-Israel animus, which is growing.
Anti-Israel, you think it's, you say anti-Israel animus. Does it have anything to do with Israel's policies in the Middle East?
Well, you can always couch anti-Semitism in reasons, you know, the Jews are this, the Jews are that. Israel policies, I would, if we had a little bit more time, I'd love to talk to you at length about that, because I think our policies have actually been very sound and very responsible.
Well, let's bring you back. We'll continue that discussion. Ambassador, thank you so much.
I look forward. Good morning.
Michael Leiter is Israel's ambassador to the United States. This is NPR News.
It's 6:19. Thanks for tuning in. This is People Powered KAXE. I'm Heidi Holton. Things going on in our region. The Tuesday Summer Concert Series continues today in Grand Rapids at noon. Percussionist Brady Kaysen and friends will perform at Grace Bible Church. And the Virginia Public Library has a Rubik's Cube tournament tomorrow at 3 p.m. There'll be one champion that will rise above the rest. Coming up Thursday, Kootaska Community Action is hosting a Juneteenth Freedom Walk. It starts at 10 a.m. at Old Central School in Grand Rapids. You can walk around Crystal Lake and return to the school for a picnic. Register by email to alicem@kootaska.org. There is a send-off for two Bemidji Special Olympians as they head to the U.S. Games to compete in bowling. Join them Thursday, June 18th, with a program at Lucky Dogs at 11:30, followed by a gathering at the Paul and Babe statues at 12:30. What's happening in your region? You can text us, 218-326-1234. Looking at the weather for today, it looks like it's going to be a lovely June 16th. We are seeing temperatures across the region, 67 to 72, partly to mostly sunny skies. Northwest winds 5 to 10. They could gust up to 20. Overnight temperatures in the mid-40s to low 50s with a slight chance of showers.
Support for NPR comes from this station. And from EBSCO, dedicated to empowering medical affairs teams with peer-reviewed research, AI-powered summaries, and tools for literature reviews. Learn more at EBSCO.com. From Fisher Investments, Fisher's dedicated team of specialists provide resources on investing, retirement income, estate planning, and more. Learn more at FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. From the University of Maryland Libraries, dedicated to making UMD's research available to everyone and advancing open access for the public good. More at lib.umd.edu. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Amy Martinez.
I'm Leila Fadel.
And I'm Michelle Martin. Good morning. Long before Raphael Warnock was sworn in as the junior U.S. Senator from Georgia, he became the senior pastor at Atlanta's Ebenezer Baptist Church, where the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once delivered sermons, and Warnock still does. That's how he came to preach at the National Cathedral at an event to recognize Juneteenth as a federal holiday, and he read a passage from Isaiah, a text in the Hebrew Bible also referenced in the Gospels.
Every valley shall be exalted. Every mountain and hill shall be made low, the crooked places shall be made straight, the rough places smooth, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together.
Warnock expanded that sermon into a new book titled The Crooked Places Made Straight, Reflections on the Moral Meaning of America, where he calls for Americans to commit to what he calls a greater moral imagination in our politics. But even before the book was out, his critique of the way many current politicians apply faith to policy sparked a conversation. In an interview with the New York Times, Senator Warnock said that after Congress passed the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, he questioned whether the Christianity cited by some Republicans, including House Speaker Mike Johnson, is more performative than substantive. Soon after the interview published, Speaker Johnson reached out to Senator Warnock. Senator Warnock describes the discussion.
We agree to disagree. There are fundamental differences between how we understand the faith. I want to respect the integrity of our private conversation, but I don't think I'm betraying any confidences when I say that he has a view of the faith that is very personal and privatistic. It's about personal piety. And I think that matters. Certainly the faith speaks to one's personal conduct. But Scripture also speaks about systems, about systemic injustice. The prophets, as I pointed out to him in that meeting, are not just pointing out a few venal individuals in a system that otherwise is fine. They are decrying injustice in their moment. Isaiah says that God says through Isaiah, I cannot endure solemn assemblies with iniquity. Although you make many prayers, I will not listen. Your hands are full of blood. Public policy is a matter of life and death. When you knock 15 million people off of their health care, when you double the health care for another 22 million people, people die. People die as a result of that.
So for some decades now, Republicans have been the ones who have been associated with citing religious values, especially conservative Christian values, as the animating force behind their politics and their policy choices. What is your intention with this book? Is it to argue that progressives like yourself can and should also animate their politics with their faith principles?
Well, I want to talk to all of us, people on the left and the right, because I think what we're dealing with right now is not the difference between right and left. It's really the difference between right and wrong. It's wrong to crush people. And I think it's really too bad when my party cedes so much of the faith and values space and language to those on the right, especially since more often than not, in my view, they've got it wrong.
Well, to that end, though, there are those who would say that this melding of religious belief and policy is in part what is driving the toxicity in our politics. Because it's not just about, oh, we disagree. It's about, oh, you are wrong. And not just wrong, you're evil. Your politics are sinful, that sort of thing. And I just wonder if...
It's not how I approach it. My faith is not a weapon. It's a bridge. And what I offer in the book is not a condemnation, but an invitation, even with those who are my political opponents.
How does that work, though,
to remind
when
us,
you're coming from a specific set of understandings?
Oh, I think faith requires humility. And the toxicity that you are describing, which is absolutely right, is corrosive, and it often comes from a place of orthodoxy. I have the truth and all of the truth. There's always the temptation for people of faith and religion to take that position. But in my view, it really is the opposite of faith. Faith requires humility. If you've got all the answers, then I don't know what you got, but it's something other than faith. Right? Faith is a substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen. And so I think part of how our vision is clarified, particularly for those who are in power, is to talk to powerless people. That's why our policy is so wrong right now, because people in Washington are caught up in silos. And it's the reason why I try so hard to stay connected to the people. I preach every Sunday in my pulpit. Mm-hmm. I promised the people of Georgia that I would walk with them even as I work for them. Mm-hmm. I'll tell you this. One of the things that the speaker said to me was, oh, you know, yeah, the Bible talks about the poor, but he's really just talking about personal conduct, which is wrong. Scripture is not limited to that. And we have tragic examples in history, as I pointed out to him, about what happens when we cede all of that space. That's how you end up with a Christian slavocracy, when you decide that the issue is your soul and individual conduct and systems don't matter. You end up with a contradiction like a Christian slavocracy. We're in a dark moment in our country, and there are those who are trying to weaponize despair. But here's the battle we cannot lose. We cannot lose the battle for the soul of the country. We cannot lose the battle that says we still have hope and there's a reason to keep fighting. That's the battle we can't afford.
And what's that reason?
To lose.
What is the reason?
Because when you lose hope, you stop fighting. And they do win. I think about John Lewis, whose funeral I presided over. I was his pastor. Mm-hmm. And I think about him crossing that Edmund Pettus Bridge. And as I was preparing to preside over his funeral, I said, what was he thinking when he was crossing that bridge? Was he thinking he would be hailed one day as an American hero? No, he wasn't thinking about that. I think John Lewis was just trying to stay alive that day so he could fight the next. He understood that democracy is a contact sport. And that's what I'm saying to the country in this moment. Whatever you do, keep walking. He crossed that bridge and built the bridge at the same time. The thing I love about our country is we always have a path to make it better, and I'm determined to make it better. I'm not about to give this country over to a wannabe authoritarian.
That is Senator Raphael Warnock of Georgia. He's a Democrat and senior pastor at Ebenezer Baptist Church in Atlanta. His latest book is The Crooked Places Made Straight, Reflections on the Moral Meaning of America. Senator, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be with you. Keep the faith.
This is NPR News.
It may not feel like it, but right now in large parts of the U.S., it's a renter's market. The cost of rent is not going up as quickly as other expenses like gas or electricity. The reason? Supply and demand.
There's a lot of apartment buildings hitting the market all at once, and property managers are trying to fill it.
I'm Elsa Chang. We'll check in on the country's apartments on All Things Considered from NPR News.
You can hear that story coming up today, 4 o'clock, All Things Considered, here on People Powered KAXC in the Grand Rapids area. Lots of apartments going up. What's it like where you are? You can text us 218-326-1234, including a brand new one right across from KAXC that I think was full like 6 months ago or something.
Really?
Yeah.
My.
So.
Well, you know. They've got a great view. They're looking right at us.
Yeah. I've seen photos of the higher floors, their view of the river.
Oh.
That would be cool.
Yeah. Very nice.
Yeah. Lots of people need places to live. I know housing is something that every city council, county government is talking about out there. So if you want to join the conversation, you can text us 218-326-1234. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. And John, I'm curious how you would answer our question of the week.
Yes.
What's your favorite way to eat ice cream?
Sitting down.
I know. I thought it was a little...
No, my favorite way to eat ice cream?
Yeah, like a sundae,
a
cone.
I don't particularly like a cone. I mean, I'll eat a cone. I'd eat a lot of things if it had ice cream on it. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to go on that list. But, I like my ice cream in a bowl. And if there's fresh fruit around, I'll put that on there.
Okay.
And I like sometimes to drizzle a little maple syrup on top. Yeah, I can think of a lot of ways to eat ice cream.
Do you have a favorite flavor?
Oh, absolutely. It's not available anymore, but I was a Butterbrickle fan.
Oh, Butterbrickle. I remember that.
I loved Butterbrickle, but you can't buy it anymore. Maple Nut or some other something that's supposed to come close. It isn't really. Butterbrickle is, it was my favorite. I just liked it.
Yeah.
I still do. If I go to a Dairy Queen, I always get the one with the, I have them put the Heath bar in there.
Oh, sure.
Because that's sort of like Butterbrickle.
We got some very specific answers to this already.
Oh.
Kim says strawberry malted with extra malt powder and whipped cream.
Hmm. No, thanks.
Yeah.
Strawberry's fine. Malt powder, I'm okay. Whipped cream, I could care less. Feed it to the dog. I mean, I would eat it, I suppose, but it would just be in the way of the ice cream.
We have found an ice cream that we get that is, I don't know if you like coffee ice cream.
Hmm.
It's a Java chunk or something. So it's got dark chocolate and then coffee ice cream in it.
Who wouldn't like that?
Really, really good. Yeah.
Yeah. My favorite breakfast would be a dark chunk of Dove chocolate and coffee.
There you go. And put ice cream. It's pretty darn good.
Yeah. Yeah, that sounds right up my alley. I could eat that. I don't have trouble with ice cream, period. I mean, there's very, I can't even think of a flavor of ice cream that I would not eat. Yeah. Some with more relish than others. It's, for me, it's a bit like beer, you know. All beer is good. Some is better than others.
I remember waiting in line when I lived near Grand Avenue in St. Paul at Grand Ole Creamery. Is that what it's called? Their homemade ice cream, and it was in a waffle cone. You'd see Paul Wellstone waiting in line there.
Oh, my.
But it had a little malted milk ball on the bottom of the homemade waffle cone.
Oh,
that was the
wow.
Nice little treat.
But yeah.
Man, was that delicious. Well. Ooh. Worth waiting in line for.
Yes, indeed. I was talking with a friend of mine, had the pleasure of going to a baseball game this weekend with a couple of good friends, and we talked quite a bit about the two of us grew up in Grand Rapids. And we both remembered when there were two creameries in town.
Oh.
And one of the tours that we took as children from the school was to go to the creamery and watch them make ice cream bars.
Oh, my gosh.
And we would get an ice cream bar right fresh out of the...
Wow.
Yeah, it didn't even come with a package on it. It just came as an ice cream bar. Here you go, kids.
That is an experience you have never forgotten, I'm sure.
Nope, I can still... I can't drive to the place where the creamery is because they put something else up there.
Okay.
Blend and Woodlot.
Huh.
But, yeah, those were the days.
Right.
That's when, and you know what kind of prompted that was the discussion about how the old farmers, well, the old settlers all ran, you know, you had a farm, you had a small farm, you had maybe 8 or 10 cows, you had some pigs, you had chickens, maybe you had sheep, maybe not, but you had the basics. You had chicken, you had pigs, and you had cows. And so you were getting milk and beef, you were getting pork and bacon, and let's see, what was the third one? At any rate, what happened was the farmers would let their cows loose in the woods, and the woods was the pasture. And they didn't cut the trees. They just let the cows go, and the cows would sort of keep the grass down, and they would suppress a lot of the brush that they would maybe eat or just trample. And it resulted in a park-like setting in the woods where the red-headed woodpeckers would be just happy as could be. And in those days, I remember seeing red-headed woodpeckers every summer. Every summer there were red-headed woodpeckers around. I saw one 2 weeks ago up at Williams Narrows Resort, and that's the first one I've seen in several years. I get reports of them occasionally. Some of you listening this morning are lucky enough to have a red-headed woodpecker nearby. But there are a lot fewer of them than there were when I was a child. And part of that reason is the way that we manage our woodlots. We don't let the cows just run through the woods anymore. And we don't have a lot of old wooden fence posts, which provided cavities for the woodpeckers to nest in as well. So that has come and gone. Now, you know, your dairy comes from 10,000 herd cows, or 1,000 herds of, or 1,000 head of cows who mostly just amble through the milking parlor continuously. And so it's just not the same. They don't allow them to just run loose in the woods anymore. That's not happening. So the red-headed woodpeckers have suffered. And golf courses are a good place to try and find red-headed woodpeckers now. But few other areas offer the kind of territory habitat that they like.
We're going to be talking about habitat. We're going to be talking about what we're seeing maybe in the woods. I was out mowing over the weekend, saw my first butterfly. So it's exciting.
Nice.
I'm looking it up, trying to see which one. I think it would have been a morning cloak.
Dark with a white band. I'll bet it was a white admiral.
Oh, okay.
The reason I say that is I saw my first white admiral this week, and the white admiral is just coming into the area, and the morning cloak, they overwinter as adults, and so they were out earlier, and I have seen some. I think I saw one a week or two ago. I'd have to check my notes, but typically this time of year, there are not very many of them. They've laid their eggs and died, and the eggs are caterpillars now, and they will hatch out in the late summer, and then we'll see them flying around a bit in the fall, and then those that we see in the fall will overwinter as adults, and they'll be the first ones we see again in the spring. But typically mid-June, a big dark butterfly with a white band is going to be a white admiral.
Okay.
The morning cloak is, it's entirely possible you did see that.
No, I think
be kind of
right.
Cream-colored band on the outer edge of the wing would be a morning cloak. A bright white band right through, not the center of the wing, but definitely in from the edge of the wing would be the white admiral.
And also I'm trying to pay more attention to the Dragonfly Heroes.
You talking about dragonflies this morning. Yeah.
I have a hard time remembering the name of the one. It seems like such a long name.
Are you thinking of the chalk-fronted corporal?
Yes.
That one is quite prominent right now. It's yesterday it was the most common one that I saw. But I also saw emeralds, and I saw club tails, and I saw a little black one that I didn't get a good ID on. I tried to take its picture, and the picture was a little too fuzzy for me to pin it down. But this is the time of year that the dragonflies are definitely coming out and in force. If you're lucky, Dallas Hudson lives in such a place. If you're lucky and you live along a lake or near a lake, you might be seeing the eastern pond hawk. And the male eastern pond hawk is the color of the sky. It is pale blue. The female eastern pond hawk is the color of the trees. It is bright green. And the whole body, head to tail.
Yeah.
Male is blue. Female is green. They're one of my favorites. I still remember exactly where I was when I saw my first one. It was that shocking. It was like, boink.
So
wow.
It's the female eastern pond hawk that's the bright green.
Yes.
Okay.
And the male is blue. And
okay.
They're stunning, both of them.
All right. I'm going to keep my eyes out. We're going to be hearing after National Native News. We've got some talkbacks that have come in and some of the things that folks are seeing. Don't forget, this time of the year is when we really need you, whether it is texting in 218-326-1234 or leaving us a SpeakPipe message. We've got a couple of those today. And our students are done with school, and so we don't have quite as many reports coming in. So that means we need your help. Also, you can sign up for that Season Watch podcast or the newsletter. And I've been watching a little bit more, too, the Season Watch Facebook page. Always. It never stops being busy, which I totally love.
Yeah. Yeah, it's pretty amazing.
You can check it out. All of this available at kaxe.org. Let's take a look at the weather for today. It's kind of a chilly morning. We are seeing temperatures right now across the region. Let's see, 51 in Grand Rapids, 46 in Bagley, 51 in Hibbing, 48 in Bemidji, Aiken at 50 with rain. And Brainerd reporting 51. We could see some more rain through the day. We're just early today. Chance of showers for tonight. We're looking at temperatures in the mid-40s to low 50s. Today, during the day, is going to get up to upper 60s to low 70s. And then some more rain, possible thunderstorms moving in tomorrow. Highs in the low to mid-60s.
Support comes from the Friends of Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge near McGregor, offering 18,000 acres of woods, water, and wildlife for the public to experience, located 5 miles south of McGregor on Highway 65. Learn more about Friends of Rice Lake National Wildlife Refuge events and activities on Facebook.
This is National Native News. I'm Jill Freitas. Despite the Navajo Nation DOJ advising government staff not to testify about a failed multi-million dollar housing project, one employee broke ranks. KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrasio has details.
So far, Navajo Nation controller Sean McCabe has been the sole witness out of a dozen or so to comply with the Budget and Finance Committee's subpoenas.
Would you please stand and raise your right hand? Do you solemnly swear or affirm that the statements you make during your testimony shall be the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth?
I do. My intention today is not to undermine a DOJ advisement. My intention is to fulfill my professional duties as a certified public accountant.
Yet McCabe was still cautious on Wednesday.
I would have hoped that legal counsel was here to step in if I needed it, if I was breaching any client attorney privileges, but it doesn't appear that they are.
The Zenny Home hearing is set to wrap up this week. For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrasio.
Members of the Confederated Tribes of Siletz Indians recently shared their perspective on harvesting a humpback whale last November. As KLCC's Brian Bull reports, the harvest highlights the whale's cultural significance to coastal native communities.
For nearly 2 hours, the group spoke to 165 people at the Amanda Trail site in Yahats, near where the 10-ton juvenile humpback washed ashore last fall. Despite efforts by locals to save it, it was ultimately euthanized on the beach. Shortly after, a team of Siletz tribal members arrived to harvest parts of the mammal, while another team from Oregon State University did a necropsy. During their talk, the Siletz said they wanted to get across that the joy many felt that day wasn't because of the whale's death, but because they were able to practice a traditional harvest that hadn't been done for generations. Lisa Norton, the tribe's chief administrative officer, said this was due to several factors.
We've got forced relocation. We've got 1932, the Marine Mammal Relocation Act, the Termination Act of 54. We were forbidden from practicing.
Norton's son, Joshua Relatus, talked of carving the baleen and blubber from the whale, much like his ancestors did. At the end, the audience gave the Siletz a standing ovation. Relatus said he was pleased that the event was well received.
It was a little nerve-wracking at first because you never know what to expect from the community, especially because of social media and just the perceptions people have. But people here have got a pretty good understanding of what it was like for us and the respect and love that we had for the animal.
While some online commenters made racist remarks or generalizations about Native people during the harvest, supporters say the amount of reverence and respect paid to the whale showed how important it was for the Siletz to do it. Chief Doug Barrett of the Confederated Tribes of Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siosla Indians said he'd like to consult with tribes like the Siletz and Makah to better understand whale harvesting. A dead whale recently washed ashore in his region.
I did what I could with what I had. I had my four knives and I went up there and just started taking what I could. And I would like to render the blubber out so I could put oil on our canoes.
Joanne Cattell is co-chair of the conservationist nonprofit View the Future, which sponsored the Siletz's presentation. She said the group picked the Amanda Trail in Yahats because of its significance to Native history.
This area symbolizes the government-sponsored genocidal policies that led to the murder and deaths of so many Coos, Umpqua, Siuslaw, and LC people here in the Yahats area. And this whole area and the Amanda Trail bring that historical truth to the present.
Cattell says she wasn't surprised 165 people turned out to hear the Siletz's story. She added that it's important to have these conversations in an open and welcoming space. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull in Yahats, Oregon.
And I'm Jill Freitas.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Alaska has Fresh Start programs to lose weight, lower blood sugar or blood pressure, stop smoking, vaping, or chewing tobacco. Many programs are no cost or low cost. Visit freshstart.alaska.gov to find the program that's right for you.
This National Native News, you hear it weekday mornings at this time. It is 6:47. I'm Heidi Holton with John Latimer. Thanks so much for being with us on this June 16th.
Looks like it's turning into a kind of a nice morning. It was a little cloudy and rainy when I first got up, but it looks much more promising right now.
Yeah, could get into the low 70s for today. Possible rain coming in again tonight with temperatures in the mid-40s to low 50s. And good chance for showers, possible thunderstorms for tomorrow. We are glad to hear it. Highs in the low to mid-60s.
We certainly need the rain, no doubt about that. The turtles have been slow to come out and lay eggs because it hasn't rained. It's dry. And they like to come out right after a rain. Last week when we talked, they had just begun to come up, but I haven't seen any in the subsequent week. Last Tuesday was the last ones I saw. Support comes from the Paul Bunyan Communications, powered by the GigaZone, offering fiber optic fast internet speeds up to 10 gig and GigaZone Wi-Fi to support devices wirelessly. Paul Bunyan Communications, Northern Minnesota's local broadband cooperative. You know that gig and GigaZone, if you'd said that word to me as a fifth grader, I would have just looked at you like, what? What word is that? We receive support from Rapids Brewing Company, a place of gathering and community featuring live music multiple times a week, farm-fresh foods, and rotating beers from their own brew house. More information about their events, music, and menu available at rapidsbrewingco.com. It is time for our talkback segment, and those of you who are regular or frequent listeners know that this is the time when we invite our listeners to give us a call or send us an audio of whatever is going on in their neighborhood. And this morning we have half a dozen or so people who have communicated with us, and we're going to share those with you in just a minute. First of all, I need to tell you that funding for Phenology Talkbacks is provided in part by the Minnesota Environment and Natural Resources Trust Fund. Phenology Talkbacks are produced by Charlie Mitchell. Our first report is from Josh Leonard at Belwin Outdoor Science.
Okay, Season Watch. This is my last school year report here from Belwin Outdoor Science. Today is the last day of school, June 12th, for St. Paul Public Schools. So here we go from Belwin Outdoor Science near Afton, Minnesota. On Monday, June 8th, we had ground cherry blooming, Kinnikinnick dewberry blooming. It looks like a strawberry plant, but the berries look like blackberries or raspberries. We had a large painted turtle laying eggs. Narrow leaf hawksbeard was blooming. I really want to know what beard means for flowers, because it doesn't seem beard-like at all. And, you know, like penstemon can also be called a large flowered beard tongue. I think that's weird how beard gets woven into flower names, of all things. Prairie alum root was blooming. Prairie phlox was blooming. And we also had woolly milkweed blooming. I posted that on iNaturalist a year or two ago, and a professor showed up from Chicago to take a picture of it. I'm pretty sure it was the woolly milkweed. It could have been another one that's in the same area. Let's see. We found a hognose snake shed on Tuesday, June 9th. Mourning dove fledgling was seen walking around on the ground, and we didn't know what to do with it. Poor thing. It fledged too early or left the nest too early. Also on Tuesday, June 9th, we had a Blanding's turtle. We have the rare Blanding's turtle here on site at Belwin, and it likely laid eggs on Tuesday, June 9th. We have this wonderful person, Jim Rue, who follows her around at midnight, 1 a.m, making sure that she's laying her eggs and where the nest is so that he can protect it from nest predators. And this year is one of 2 years out of the past, maybe 15, that she gave Mr. Rue the slip. So she moves away from the pond to lay her eggs, and then like way up onto the hilltop. And then she returns to the slough, and he found her in the slough on the morning of Wednesday, June 10th. So we're bummed that that we don't know where the nest is, but hopefully she will have a successful nesting season. Also wanted to point out that an invasive called Grecian foxglove was blooming. If you go to remove it, make sure you're wearing gloves, because that can have a chemical in it that can stimulate your heart, I believe. And then also, we're just so thankful for the rain that we've had this week. We had 0.3 inches yesterday on June 11th, and then we had 0.34 inches on June 10th, and a smattering of other rain earlier this week. And so thankful for the cooler temperatures as well. Thank you.
Thank you, Josh. Josh, by the way, is a friend and is an excellent naturalist, runs a great program at Belwin. If you're down in the cities, it's on the east side, sort of between St. Paul and the St. Croix River, and it is a gorgeous place, and you would be welcome there. And you would see many of these plants that I would be absolutely a neophyte there. I would have to be pointed out to me and explained. Ground cherry, I think I might recognize. Kinnikinnick dewberry, I would definitely need to have that pointed out to me. He talks about the painted turtle laying eggs. Narrow-leafed hawk's beard, and he got into that little discussion about beards and what it might mean, and the penstemon, which is also called large-flowered beard tongue. I have a beard, but fortunately none of it is growing on my tongue. definitely an interesting avenue to pursue, perhaps. I'll have to see what I can find out. Prairie alum root, prairie phlox, woolly milkweed. I wouldn't recognize that if you pulled it out of the ground and shook it under my nose. The shed of a hognose snake, that's pretty cool. We're going to hear about another shed of an even rarer or a more rare snake later on this morning when we hear from the people down in Caledonia. The mourning dove fledgling. The mourning dove is such an interesting bird. They are so sleek and beautiful. They have that lovely call that you're probably familiar with. It's kind of a haunting, just a coo. Anyway, they, as sleek and as lovely as they are, they build the crappiest nest you've ever seen. A mourning dove nest, honest to Pete, you can stand underneath it and you can see the eggs. This is a nest that, you know, sometimes with students, I'll bring in a big bag of material and I'll say, make a bird nest. And it's not as easy as you might think. Those birds are pretty skillful. Well, the mourning dove nest is one that you could make. I could make. Even with my fumbling fingers, I could make a mourning dove nest. They are absolutely the simplest and probably the least involved structures I've ever witnessed. And then that little story about the Blanding's turtle and Mr. Rue and how in the 15 years she's given him the slip only twice. Maybe she knows something he doesn't, and maybe this year will be the year that that her eggs are, you know, happy and come out, and there'll be more Blanding's turtles. If you should run across a turtle with a bright yellow plastron, the bottom shell, that's the Blanding's turtle. Not very common around here. Grecian foxglove digitalis, I think, is the chemistry he was talking about there. You start messing with that plant and you have a bit of heart problems, it can affect your heart. They isolated and synthesized that chemical in science and medicine, and they actually use it for just that, for heart medicine. Our next report comes from Chelsea Perkins, our news director, and she is reporting from Brainerd.
Hey, Season Watch Pod, it's your friends Chelsea and Ansel. We just got home from going for a walk right along the Mississippi River in Brainerd. It's a little before 9 p.m., and I noticed in the long grass along the road we were walking on a bunch of blue damselflies. And then I looked closer, and I realized that there was hundreds and hundreds of blue damselflies just sitting in the long grass, presumably getting ready to go to bed. But I walked for a half a mile of these in a field of blue damselflies, and it was just absolutely mesmerizing. I tried to take pictures, and of course, that just never does it justice. So I had to share with you all this amazing sight that we witnessed tonight. Thanks for all the nature fun.
Chelsea, you are absolutely a prime example of what happens when you get outside and you open your eyes. My wife is a person much like you, and she was out walking yesterday, and her observation was exactly yours. The huge number of those little blue damselflies, most of them are bluets, blue with a T at the end, bluet. And they are determined, you can determine which bluet they are by looking at the pattern of blue on their abdomen. And it's often bands of blue, and you need to count them, and you need to see where they're located, front or back. And all of that will help you determine which bluet you're looking at. But believe me, a bluet is just a lovely little damselfly. And of course, for those of you who are new to this study of Odonata, the toothed winged flyers, they The damselflies, when they are at rest, their wings lay parallel to their abdomen. Dragonflies, the wings are perpendicular to the abdomen, and they have no way of making them parallel. So if you're looking at it at rest and the wings are parallel to the abdomen, it is a damselfly. And there are some big ones and some really brightly colored ones. The river jewel wing and the there's another jewel wing. Both of them are metallic blue-green bodies with black wings. So not all of the damselflies are these little tiny bluets that you're likely to see many of. Some of them are quite large and quite distinctive. We will continue with our talkback segment coming up in the 7 o'clock hour, probably about quarter to 8. So tune back in. We've got a report from Zeta, and we've got a report from
Caledonia.
Caledonia has sent in another report, and Minnesota schools